From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we look at the past, present, and future of computers with Steve Jobs. He co-founded Apple, is now CEO of Next Computer Incorporated, and he's the president of Pixar, which produced Toy Story, the first computer-animated feature film. Also today, goodbye to the Ramones, the punk band which formed 20 years ago is on its final tour before calling it quits. We'll hear from music critic Milo Miles, who caught the band's final Boston show last week. Then we'll feature an excerpt of a 1988 interview with Joey Ramone. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Angels and Insects. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. The Navy today ordered a three-day halt to flights of all F-14 fighter jets following the crash of an F-14 in the Persian Gulf today. Two crew members aboard the jet received only minor injuries as a result of the accident. Today's mishap was the third F-14 crash in less than a month. Most of the GOP presidential hopefuls will meet in Tempe, Arizona tonight for a debate at Arizona State University. Bob Dole will not be among them. State Party Chair Dodie Londen calls Dole's decision a kind of a snub and says it could hurt him in next week's primary. Polls show more than half of the state's Republicans have not yet made up their minds. Indiana Senator Dick Lugar has decided to sit out the primaries during the next 2 weeks anyway, as his funds begin to dwindle. At a news conference in Washington, Lugar said he's not quitting, just realigning his forces.
These 2 weeks will give me additional time to focus the attention of Republicans on constructive ways to address not only the fears of job insecurity, but the fervent hopes of parents attempting to save money for their children's education, of students trying to finance college education, of Americans of all ages striving to provide for retirement savings.
Lugar says he'll concentrate his effort on New England's regional primary March 5th. Attorney General Janet Reno says the Justice Department is looking into a number of options for keeping survivors of the Oklahoma City bombing and victims' relatives up to date on the progress of the trial, which will be held in Denver. Craig Windham reports.
Earlier this week, U.S. District Judge Richard Mache ordered the trial of Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols moved away from Oklahoma to ensure that an unbiased jury could be selected. Federal court rules prohibit TV broadcast from courtrooms, but Reno says the department is studying whether closed-circuit TV could be used to beam the proceedings back to some location in Oklahoma City. She emphasized, however, that this should not be considered an opening for possible live broadcast coverage of the trial. The media will have access, she said, but not with cameras. Among the other options being considered for victims and their families are daily recorded news summaries that would be made available by telephone. And Reno says the department is also looking into whether special stipends could be offered for those who want to travel to Denver. I'm Craig Windham in Washington.
Bosnian President Alija Izetbegovic has been hospitalized with heart trouble. A spokesman says Izetbegovic, who is 70, is stable but must remain hospitalized. It's not known for how long. Bosnia's collective presidency has convened an emergency session to decide who should be in charge. President Clinton today handed Congress his formal request for money to support the Bosnian peacekeeping operation. Under the plan, the $820 million would come from the Defense Department budget. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up over 78 points at 5594.37, volume 390 million shares. This is NPR News. A jury in Texas has acquitted NFL quarterback Warren Moon of misdemeanor assault charges against his wife. Lisa Garvin of member station KUHH reports from Houston.
The Fort Bend County jury took less than a half hour to find Minnesota Vikings quarterback Warren Moon not guilty of choking and slapping his wife during a July incident in their home near Houston. Fort Bend County prosecutors were hoping to use the case to test a new Texas law that allows them to press charges even against the wishes of the victimized spouse. However, during the trial, Felicia Moon testified that she provoked the attack by throwing a heavy candlestick at her husband in a fight over credit cards and then kneed him in the groin. Warren Moon testified yesterday about his wife's hot temper. Mrs. Moon mouthed thank you to the six jurors in the case after their verdict and told reporters afterwards she and her husband will work on their marriage. For National Public Radio, I'm Lisa Garvin in Houston.
Cleanup continues in a remote mountain pass near Leadville, Colorado, where a freight train derailment took two lives yesterday. Crews worked in waist-deep snow, spreading tons of potash to neutralize and absorb thousands of gallons of sulfuric acid that spilled from the toppled freight cars. Authorities aren't sure what caused the train to jump the tracks. A public interest group today called on Congress to drop plans to deregulate railroad safety. Citizen Action says serious accidents in just the past month should convince Congress that it should be looking at ways to make rail travel safer. Instead, the group says lawmakers are looking at legislation next week that does the opposite. Family and friends of Gary Dockery say they're hopeful after his recovery from surgery last week. Dockery began speaking after more than 7.5 years of silence, but had to undergo an operation that threatened to cause a relapse. Dockery spoke again yesterday. Doctors say they're taking it one step at a time. In over-the-counter trading at this hour, the NASDAQ Composite Index is up over 19 points. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The history of the computer would have been different if it weren't for my guest, Steven Jobs. He co-founded Apple Computer, the company that pioneered the user-friendly computer. He oversaw the creation of the Macintosh. He was ousted from the company in 1985 and formed a new computer company called Next. The computer designed by Next was a commercial failure. Now the company is creating software for the World Wide Web. Jobs is also the head of Pixar, the computer animation company that produced Toy Story, the first computer animated feature-length film. Jobs became a billionaire when Pixar went public in November. I asked Jobs first about the software Next produces. It's designed to make pages on the World Wide Web interactive. I asked him why they're usually static now.
Well, you know, as you know, the web's a pretty miraculous thing, and it was a very simple paradigm that was invented, which was that people could construct web pages in some arcane languages, one called HTML, and people could then touch those pages and view them with a browser. Now, these things are created by human beings for the most part, and they're fairly laborious to create. Once you make one, people can view it. So you can be viewing a web page along with a 250,000 other people looking at exactly the same page. And it's pretty miraculous how it all works, and with the internet being wired everywhere and with the navigation that's been put in with the web. You can navigate around the web and look at all of these pages, and it's stunning how good it is. However, the page you may be looking at is the same page that everyone else is looking at if they happen to be on that website looking at that page. There's nothing custom about it for you. So if you have any questions you want answered, you're kind of out of luck, unless the person that created that page thought to answer your question, you know, a month ago when they created that page. So you might want to say, you know, where's my Federal Express package? And obviously no one created a page to tell you where the Federal Express box you sent yesterday is right now. So wouldn't it be great if you could ask questions and those questions could get answered via a web page built just for you? And that's why you might want a more dynamic web page in the simplest sense. And Federal Express did just that. They took several months and created some computer programs, which when you type in your package tracking number, will go to their mainframes, find out all the data about where your package is, get all that data, and then, you know, rather than give it to, you know, thousands of gnomes that will create these web pages on the fly, a computer program will build the web page on the fly and send it off to your web browser. And it's magic. I mean, it was made custom just for you, telling you exactly where your package was. And they've got about, you know, 10,000 people a day using the service instead of calling them, which is kind of cool. Now, that's just the tip of the iceberg. It turns out that companies, when they really want to vend, you know, information about their products or services, or they want to start doing commerce on the web, really need to start building these web pages dynamically based on, you know, what the consumer wants. And that is going to be the next big change in the web.
And this is what you're working on, enabling these pages to be more interactive.
Exactly. We call it web objects, and we announced it about 3 weeks ago. We're giving away the basic version. We put it up on our website, and it runs on servers. And we've already I think people have already downloaded close to 10,000 copies of it for free.
So how do you think that the web might change in the near future with the help of the type of software that you are producing now?
You know, I think most large companies and medium-sized companies and even small companies are starting to look at the web as the ultimate direct-to-customer distribution channel, bypassing all middlemen, going directly from the supplier to the consumer. And that's a pretty powerful concept when you think about it. One of the things that I love is that, you know, a very small company, if they invest a lot in their website, can look just as formidable and just as solid on the web as a very large company can. As a matter of fact, some of the smaller companies are more hip on the web, you know, getting more hip to the web sooner, and so they actually look better than some of the large companies do right now. And it's going to be this very leveling phenomenon. But I think a tremendous amount of goods and services is going to be sold, or at least the demand created for such things over the web.
What else do you see in the near future for the web besides the ability to shop in a more kind of complete way through the web?
It's not just shopping for goods and services. It's shopping for information. I mean, you're going to find out already, you know, when I want to find out the movies that are playing around Silicon Valley, I just go up on the local web page and check it out. It's a lot faster than going to the theater, going to the newspaper, and a lot faster than calling the theaters, et cetera. And more we're shopping for information on the web. I just recently bought a Sony, you know, one of the new Sony camcorders, you know. And I went on Sony's webpage and I found out all about the ones they offer and picked the one I wanted right from that webpage before I even called a store, you know, to try to find it physically. I basically, you know, the demand to get me to buy that thing was created from Sony's webpage. And I think we're going to see more and more of that. You're going to be buying information or, you know, finding information and really making a lot of decisions about what you're going to do with your life or what you're going to purchase from the web.
Is the whole idea of going to the store to buy software going to become obsolete, too? Do you think we'll be downloading our software from the web?
Of course. Yeah, there's no question about it. There's no question that that will happen, and I think it'll happen in the next 24 months. There's some software right now that's still very large, and the web on-ramps and off-ramps to corporations are now very fast, but the off-ramps to the consumers' homes are still not so fast. And so for buying large software such as CD-ROM games and stuff, they'll still be distributed on physical media for a while. But when the off-ramps to the consumer get faster, possibly with cable modems in the near future, then that could possibly go fully electronic as well.
So tell me what else you see for the web beyond the world of retail.
Yeah, it's not... there's a lot of things happening with the web right now in terms of allowing people access to information that they would just never have before. And what this does is, of course, it lets special interest groups get together. So, you know, you have, I know people who have had, as an example, a stroke and have gotten on the web and found that there are several web pages now devoted to information for stroke victims, where they can learn about, you know, some of the latest treatments, so they can learn about avoidance. You know, the latest in avoidance advice and things like that. And those things didn't exist before as well.
Steve Jobs is my guest. You started off in the business of designing computers. When did you start thinking that the future wasn't in building the individual computers, but rather in the computer network? I mean, because after all, what you're doing now is designing software for the web.
Right. You know, I had sort of a landmark visit to Xerox PARC in 1979, that's Palo Alto Research Center, where they invented a lot of the cornerstones of the modern graphical user interface. And actually, they showed me what they were doing in 1979, and actually they'd done three things. The first was the brilliant work they had done on graphical user interfaces. The second was networking. They had over 100 of their computers at that time networked in a fully electronic environment using email routinely. And the third thing that they'd done was object-oriented programming. They'd invented Smalltalk and other object-oriented languages as well. And I was so blinded by the brilliance of the first, the graphical user interface, that I didn't even see the other two in 1979. And so when we went to make the Macintosh, it really completed the job that they had started on the graphical user interface, but really did not address object-oriented technology, nor did it address networking.
Let's define our terms, the graphic user interface. You're talking about like icons on the computer?
Yeah, you know, using plain English in menus, icons, mm-hmm. drag and drop, all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm. And the objects that you're talking about?
Object-oriented programming is a technology that is sort of like it brings to software what the Industrial Revolution brought to the production of hard goods, which is reusable parts. The way software is built today is the same way it was built when it was invented, if you will, 50 years ago. Everything is custom. And what object-oriented technology lets you do is start to build software with, in a much more modern way, with reusable components. And you end up being able to build software about 10 times faster. And it's slowly starting to seep into the software culture. And I think it's an unstoppable trend.
And this is what you're in the business of now.
What Next does is Next works on object-oriented software and has just launched a bunch of web products which incorporate object-oriented software, bringing that technology to the web as well.
Now, when you started Next, your goal was to make a new kind of computer, but that computer failed on the market. Did that failure help lead you in the direction of working more toward the web, toward web-oriented software?
You know, when we started Next, I guess have to take credit for this, made a mistake that I don't think is terribly uncommon, which is you leave something where you were pretty successful, and the next thing you do, you try to copy a lot of the paradigms of success that worked the last time, and don't realize that the world is changing from underneath your feet. And that's what we did at Next. We made a really great computer, but the world had changed enough to where the door to establish a new hardware company really had closed, even before we started the company. We just didn't know that at the time. Fortunately, the software that we built for this computer was so far ahead of its time that even after we exited the hardware business and became a software company, we were still 5 years ahead of anybody else. And so as Next became a software company, we really had something that a lot of people wanted.
My guest is Stephen Jobs. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Stephen Jobs is my guest, co-founder of Apple Computer, now the chairman of Next Computer Incorporated, and also the head of Pixar Studios, which made Toy Story. What was the very first computer you had?
I was very lucky. I was born in San Francisco, and I grew up in Silicon Valley. And I was able to go to NASA, Ames Research Center nearby, and play with a time-sharing computer, which was a loud mechanical terminal hooked up with a wire somewhere, and there was supposedly a computer on the other end of it. And I got a chance to, program in Fortran and BASIC. And
those are the computer languages of the time.
The computer languages of the time. And I was captured by it.
And how did you get into the computer business? What made you think, this is going to be my life?
I met my future partner in Apple, Steve Wozniak, when I was about 13 years old. And he was the first person I'd met that knew more about electronics and computers than I did at the time. And we became fast friends and started to build electronic devices together. We built blue boxes together for a while, which were little devices that could allow you to make free phone calls everywhere, illegally, I might add. And
oh, so you were a hacker.
Yeah. Yeah, we built the first digital blue box in the whole world. It was wonderful. We had our tagline, which we put a little card in the bottom of each one, was "He's got the whole world in his hands." And the reason we built a computer was that we wanted one and we couldn't afford one. We couldn't afford to buy one. There were thousands of dollars at that time. We were just two teenagers, and so we started trying to build them. And, scrounging parts around Silicon Valley where we could. And after a few attempts, we managed to put together something that was the Apple One. And all of our friends wanted them, too. They wanted to build them. So it turned out that it took maybe 50 hours to build one of these things by hand. And it was taking up all of our spare time because our friends were not that skilled at building them. So Woz and I were building them for them. And we thought, you know, if we could just get what's called a printed circuit board where you could kind of just plug in the parts instead of having to hand wire the whole thing, we could cut the assembly time down from, you know, maybe 50 hours to more like, you know, an hour. And so Waz sold his HP calculator and I sold my VW microbus, and we got enough money together to pay someone to design one of these printed circuit boards for us. And our goal was to just sell them as raw printed circuit boards to our friends and make enough money to recoup our calculator and transportation. And what happened was that one of the early computers, matter of fact, the first computer store in the world, which was in Mountain View at the time, said, well, I'll take 50 of these computers, but I want them fully assembled, which was a twist that we'd never thought of. So we went and bought the parts to build 100 computers, and we built 50 of them and delivered them, and then we got paid in cash and ran back and paid the people that sold us parts for the parts. And we had then we had the classic Marxian profit realization crisis, which was our profit wasn't liquid. It was in 50 computers sitting on the floor. So we decided we had to start learning about sales and distribution so that we could sell the 50 computers and get back our money. And that's how we got into business. And we took our idea to a few companies, one where Waz worked and one where I worked at the time. And neither one was interested in pursuing it, so we started our own company.
Now you led the team that created the Macintosh. And from what I've read, it sounds like you were really the advocate for having a mouse on the Mac. Why did you push for that, and what was the argument against it?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I went to Xerox PARC, Palo Alto Research Center, in 1979, and I saw the early work on graphical user interfaces that they had done. And they had a mouse, and it was obvious that you needed a pointing device, and a mouse seemed to be the best one. We tried a bunch of other ones subsequently at Apple, and a mouse indeed was the best one. We refined it a little bit. We found that, you know, Xerox has had three buttons. We found that people would push the wrong button or be scared that they were going to push the wrong button, so they always looked at the mouse instead of the screen. So we got it down to one button so that you could never push the wrong button. Made some refinements like that. The Xerox, you know, mouse cost about $1,000 a piece to build. We had to engineer one that cost $20 to build. So we had to do a lot of those kinds of things. But the basic concept of the mouse came originally from a company called SRI through Xerox and then to Apple. And there were a lot of people at Apple that just didn't get it. We fought tooth and nail with a variety of people there who thought the whole concept of a graphical user interface was crazy. But
on what grounds?
On the grounds that it either couldn't be done, or on the grounds that real computer users didn't need, you know, menus in plain English, and real computer users didn't care about, you know, putting nice little pictures on the screen. But fortunately, I was the largest stockholder and the chairman of the company, so I won.
Steve Jobs is my guest, the co-founder of Apple Computer, now the head of Next Computer Incorporated, and also the head of Pixar Studios, which made Toy Story. Do you think that when you were ousted from Apple that people kind of wrote you off? I mean, here you are with these big successes now.
Oh, golly, I don't know. I'm sure that a lot of people did, and that was fine. It was a very painful time, as you might imagine.
Mm-hmm.
To
be forced out of the company you created?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
It was a very painful time. And but, you know, you just march forward and you try to learn from it. And one of the things I always tried to coach myself on was not being afraid to fail. You know, when you have something that doesn't work out, a lot of times people's reaction is to get very protective about ever wanting to fall on their face again. And I think that's a big mistake, because you never achieve what you want without falling on your face a few times in the process of getting there. So I've tried to not be afraid to fail. And matter of fact, I've failed quite a bit since leaving Apple.
Are you surprised at the problems Apple is having now, or did you see that coming?
I try not to talk about Apple too much. But what I will say is that the day I left Apple, we had a 10-year lead over Microsoft. And in the technology business, a 10-year lead is really hard to come by. It happens, you know, maybe a company has that once every few decades. Whether it be a Xerox or an IBM with mainframes. Apple had that with the graphical user interface. And the problem at Apple was that they stopped innovating. You know, if you look at the Mac that ships today, it's 25% different than the day I left. And that's not enough for 10 years and billions of dollars in R&D. And it wasn't that Microsoft was so brilliant or clever in copying the Mac. It's that the Mac was a sitting duck for 10 years. And that's Apple's problem, is that their differentiation evaporated. And unlike Compaq or others who play in the Intel Microsoft standard space, where Compaq only has to be 5% better than its competitors for everyone to want to buy their computers, Apple has to be 50 or 100% better. Because when you buy something that is you know, out of the mainstream a little bit, you take a risk, and you want a much bigger reward for taking that risk. And unfortunately, that differentiation has not completely evaporated, but for the most part, it has. And that's the predicament Apple's in now. And that's why, you know, cost-cutting and other things at Apple are not going to be the cure. The cure for Apple is to innovate its way out of its current predicament. And there's a lot of good people left at Apple that are capable of doing that with the proper leadership, which is what's been missing.
Some Mac users are afraid that the Mac operating system is in danger of becoming obsolete in the way that beta video became obsolete because it was outdone by VHS. What do you think?
You know, I think with the appropriate leadership at Apple, that's not going to happen. But I think, you know, we're going to have to wait and see.
Do you care? I mean, how still involved, invested do you feel in the future of Apple, the company you co-created?
I'm happy every time a Mac gets shipped. I still have people, you know, sending me emails telling me how much they love their Macs. And it's sort of, how do you explain it? It's like the first person you were ever in love with, you know? It's like your first love, and there will never be another one like it. You know, and in my case, you know, we were together for 10 years, and that's a long time. But, you know, if you move on in your life, you know, you can't always stay in love with your first girlfriend, right? So,
do you think that Apple would have been better off if it licensed its operating system to other companies, which it didn't do, and it's been criticized for?
Yeah,
until recently with Motorola. Yeah, you don't know.
Who knows?
Okay.
I have no idea.
Steven Jobs co-founded Apple Computer. He's now the head of the software company Next, and he's the president of Pixar, the computer animation company that produced Toy Story. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the early days of Apple Computer. We continue our conversation with Steven Jobs, who co-founded Apple. Also, a goodbye to the Ramones. They're breaking up after 20 years. We hear from music critic Milo Miles, then feature an excerpt of a 1988 interview with Joey Ramone. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Angels and Insects. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Steve Jobs. He's the head of Next Computer, which is producing software for the World Wide Web. He's president of Pixar Studio, which created Toy Story, the first computer-animated feature-length film. And he co-founded Apple Computer, the company that pioneered the user-friendly computer. What do you think the state of the computer would be if it weren't for Apple? This is a chance, I guess, for a really self-serving answer, but I mean, I'm really curious what you think.
I usually believe that if, you know, if one group of people didn't do something, within a certain number of years, the Times would produce another group of people that would accomplish similar things. We happened to be at the right place at exactly the right time with the right group of people, and we did some wonderful work. I'm extraordinarily proud of the work that the team at Apple did when I was there. And I think that, personally, our major contribution was a little different than some people might think. I think our major contribution was in bringing a liberal arts point of view to the use of computers.
Yeah, explain what you mean by that.
What I mean by that is that, you know, if you really look at the ease of use of the Macintosh, the driving motivation behind that was to bring not only ease of use to people so that many, many more people could use computers for non-traditional things at that time, but it was to bring, you know, beautiful fonts and typography to people. It was to bring graphics to people, not for, you know, plotting laminar flow calculations, but so that they could see beautiful, you know, photographs or pictures or artwork, etc., to help them communicate what they were doing potentially. Our goal was to bring a liberal arts perspective and a liberal arts audience to what had traditionally been, you know, a very geeky technology and a very geeky audience.
What made you think that that more liberal arts direction was the direction to head in?
Because, I mean, my perspective and the way I was raised was that that science and computer science is a liberal art. It's something that everyone should know how to use, at least, and harness in their life. It's not something that should be, you know, should be relegated to 5% of the population over in the corner. It's something that everybody should be exposed to. Everybody should have a mastery of to some extent, and that's how we viewed, you know, computation or these computation devices.
And you think that, you know, that concept really caught on in the whole industry? Eventually.
You know, it's in the it's Apple, certainly, that's the seed of Apple. You know, computers for the rest of us. And I think the sort of the liberal arts point of view still lives at Apple. I'm not so sure that it lives that many other places.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the reasons I think Microsoft took 10 years to copy the Mac was because they didn't really get it at its core.
Do you think the PC as we know it is on the verge of changing?
That's a really big question. I think the PC as we know it's going to be around for quite some time, but the heart of the question is, are we entering a time window where we might see the first successful post-PC devices? You know, personal digital assistants or PDAs attempted to be that and failed. And the next attempt is going to be, I think, these very low-cost consumer internet appliances, which is, can somebody make a $300 box that hooks up to your television on one side and maybe hooks up to ISDN or a cable modem on the other side and allows you, you know, for $300 to have a web browser on your TV and to access the entire internet? And I think that's entirely possible. And I think that we're going to see those devices soon, and hopefully some innovative marketing and distribution techniques surrounding those devices, so that, you know, a lot of people can all of a sudden have an internet browser in their living room. And I think that's going to be very exciting. And I think that could be the beginning of the first real post-PC market.
I know at Apple there was, at least early on, a very informal, you know, non-corporate type of atmosphere. I wonder if there are any lessons you learned about what worked and didn't work in the corporate lifestyle at Apple that you've applied to your current companies, Next and Pixar.
Well, you know, I don't know what a corporate lifestyle is. I mean, Apple was a corporation. We were very conscious of that. We were very driven to make money so that we can continue to invest in the things we loved. I would say Apple was a corporate lifestyle, but it had a few very big differences to other corporate lifestyles that I'd seen. The first one was a real belief that that there wasn't a hierarchy of ideas that mapped into the hierarchy of the organization. In other words, great ideas could come from anywhere, and that we better sort of treat people in a much more egalitarian sense in terms of where the ideas came from. And Apple was a very bottoms-up company when it came to a lot of its great ideas. And we hired, you know, truly great people and gave them the room to, you know, to do great work. And a lot of companies don't do that. They hire people to tell them what to do. We hired people to tell us what to do. We figure we're paying them all this money. You know, their job is to figure out what to do and tell us. And that meant that led to a very different corporate culture, and one that's really, you know, much more collegial than hierarchical.
But in spite of this kind of different approach to the corporate hierarchy, it was probably still a very high-stress place.
Well, you know, we were very young, and most of the folks were not married, and so they could work, you know, 15-hour days. So you didn't have a typical situation where, you know, you work so that you can support your life. Your work was your life in many cases.
Do you feel you've changed from that? Is that still your life?
I feel it is still my life, but it's not all my life.
Mm-hmm.
It's less, you know, it's less of a percentage, but I still don't really, I've never been able to sort of think of my work and my life as different things. They're the same thing, but it where it used to be, you know, 99% of my life, it's, you know, maybe 50% of my life now.
You've had a very big success with Pixar, your computer animation company, which created Toy Story. And in fact, I think you became a billionaire when it went public last November. What made you think that part of your future would lie in computer animation? I mean, I understand the connection with what you'd been doing at Apple, but it's still a pretty different application of it.
You know, I have spent a lot of my life in computer graphics. The Apple II was the first personal computer that had color graphics on it. The Macintosh's ease of use was obtained through the use of better graphics than had ever been on a computer to date at that time. And the LaserWriter was using PostScript and was very graphics intensive. But nothing that I had ever been involved in was as good as what I saw Pixar was doing when I met a man named Ed Catmull in 1986, and he was then running a division of Lucasfilm that was up for sale. And Ed and I really hit it off, and he had a dream to make the world's first computer animated feature film, which I bought into both spiritually and financially. And so we formed Pixar in 1986, buying the division from Lucasfilm and starting to add people with that vision in mind. And there's an incredible team of people at Pixar that have worked for 10 years to make that dream come true.
As the head of Pixar Studios, what was your involvement with the actual creation of Toy Story? What level did you function on?
You know, I didn't get to animate one frame. We've got people that are so great at that, that they're the best in the world, that unfortunately, not being a visual artist myself, you know, there were several of us that didn't get to really help make the film per se. What I was able to do was try to make the environment in which, you know, the great team that we have that made the film could successfully make the film. So I had to negotiate the deal with Disney and all of the other things in terms of running the company that were more of this really just support for the great team that made the film. The most incredible thing to me, though, was Pixar was the first time in my life that I went from worrying about, you know, supplying computers to other people to being a consumer of computation. You know, as an example, each frame in Toy Story took on average 300 megabytes of data to represent all of the elements in that frame.
Wow.
And there's 114,000 frames in that film. So, you know, each one of those frames took on average 3 hours to draw using the fastest computers around. So we were a consumer of computers for the first time. And it was really great. You know, when somebody comes out with a faster computer, it used to be, oh, no. And now it's hooray.
Steve Jobs co-founded Apple Computer. He's now the head of the software company Next, and he's the president of Pixar, the computer animation company that produced Toy Story. Coming up, we say goodbye to the Ramones. This is Fresh Air. The founders of American punk rock are hanging it up. After playing together more than 20 years, the Ramones are on their final tour. Commentator Milo Miles caught the band's final Boston concert on Valentine's Day.
Fans were packed into the Avalon Club like 1,500 black leather and flannel-wrapped sardines. They were there to say goodbye to the Ramones, who reduced rock to a needle of noise in the mid-70s and made pop history. If the audience had a lot less sense of being beyond redemption than they did back then, well, everyone there was a child of the Ramones, even so. Singer Joey and guitarist Johnny are the only original members remaining, though drummer Marky is a long-timer. They began in the era of the Eagles, persisted until the heyday of Nirvana, and outlasted both of them. Linda Ronstadt once called the Ramones hemorrhoid music, and considering the source, that's quite a compliment. I would only add that they were perfectly dopey, delightful, and defiant to the end. This Ramones show was hardly changed from the 1979 concert recording It's Alive. Most of the newer songs were just less distinctive. They picked one choice oddity, the theme from the movie Pet Sematary, probably a nod to their buddy Stephen King. But everybody knew the catchy choruses, and the relentless blur of guitar and drum beats was an assault so familiar it was almost cozy. The Ramones were frustrated they never had at least a couple big hits, and rightly so. Blatant imitators like Green Day proved that the Ramones sound, while it was ahead of its time, is suitable for a mass audience. The Ramones offered a complete vision of life that fit their rugged, minimal rock. Everything centered on teenage strife in the suburbs of New York City. A cheap date at Rockaway Beach, dinner at White Castle, a horror movie on TV, maybe a little glue sniffing in the basement. Ramones songs were seedy romance at its most vivid. But around the time of the 1976 bicentennial, America just wasn't buying. The full flowering of punk rock would be more lurid and humorlessly violent than the Ramones ever imagined, and perhaps the worse for that. The Ramones are indeed like cartoons in that their art is simplified but not simple, and at its best, endlessly repeatable and effective. Their first four albums, Ramones, Leave Home, Rocket to Russia, and Road to Ruin, are masterpieces. And that's four more than even very good bands usually manage. They even inspire people. In a sort of Valentine's Day special at their Boston show, a guy and a gal kissed while floating on a sea of bodies in the mosh pit close to the stage. And none of it, the crowd, the mosh pit, the kissers, would have been the same without the Ramones.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer living in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The founders of the Ramones grew up in the New York City borough of Queens. When they formed the band, they each took on the last name of Ramone. I spoke with lead singer Joey Ramone in 1988. When the Ramones started playing 20 years ago, their punk music sounded radically different from the music of the time. I asked Joey Ramone if they thought of their music as more connected to the roots of rock and roll than to the progressive rock of the 70s.
Yeah, well, that's what we're reacting against. Rock and roll wasn't rock and roll anymore. I mean, it was fused with all kinds of things. I mean, albums became six cuts. You know, like, you wouldn't hear songs anymore. They were non-existent. They were, like, all kinds of jams and guitar solos and total cliche pretentiousness. I mean, it was... rock and roll was always simple and exciting and pure and from the guts. And if you listen to Buddy Holly or Elvis Presley or the Beatles or the Stones or the Who, I mean, that was exciting music. That was exciting rock and roll music. I mean, what, you know, what happened to it, it just didn't, it was a void, you know what I mean?
So you were playing really short songs under 3 minutes.
Well, with the songs we grew up on that, you know, that was rock and roll music were 3 minute songs, you know, I mean, whether it be the Beatles or the Stones or the Kinks or the Who or the, you know, the American bands, you know, Phil Spector, you know, songs were meant to be short. You know, they weren't supposed to go on for hours, you know.
I don't want to be a beanhead no more. I just met a nurse that I could go for. I don't want to be a beanhead no more. I just met a nurse that I could go for.
A lot of your songs were basically two, three, or four chords with a real thrashing rhythm, and I was wondering if the musicians in the band just played a few chords because that's all they could play, or it's because they all, or was it all they wanted to play?
Well,
or does it not matter to you?
No, because see, you're wrong there. I mean, yeah, a lot of the songs were like three or four chords, but then if you listen to Buddy Holly or Elvis Presley or Little Richard, those songs are three chords too. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't understand what people are saying. You know, I mean, rock and roll was always simplistic, and that's where the intensity is. I mean, that it's like short and simple and exciting and spontaneous. That's what rock and roll is, spontaneity.
You started out playing at CBGB's, the club in New York that became known as the center of the punk scene in the mid-70s. What were the initial reactions the Ramones got when they first started to play there?
Well, our first audience there were Hildy Crystal, who's the proprietor, the bartender and his dog. Those were the first people who came to see us, because CBGB's was a slum bar that nobody would come to, and they came to much later, you know. And it was like word of mouth in the beginning, you know. And then we got the Warhol crowd, you know, because the gays were always first to pick up on things.
When the word punk was coined to describe the kind of music you and other bands were playing, what did you think of the word of punk rock?
Well, we got tagged punk rock. We always considered ourselves rock and roll, you know. And to me, like my feelings about the term punk is like an attitude. And like some people are punks and some people aren't, you know. And it's really a state of being, the term punk. I mean, Elvis Presley was a punk. Jim Morrison was a punk. Iggy Pop is a punk, you know. Mick Jagger. So if you're gonna call us punk, I mean, no, I'm not gonna mind. I mean, I think John F. Kennedy was a punk, you know.
When you first started singing songs like "Teenage Lobotomy," I think you were no longer a teenager, probably in your early 20s when that came out. And I guess I was curious about singing and writing so many songs with teenage type lyrics, yet not really being in your teens any longer.
Well, it's all state of mind, isn't it? I don't get old. I decided I wasn't going to get old, and I'm still the same.
Joey Ramone recorded in 1988. The Ramones are breaking up after 20 years.
Well, the kids are all hopped up and ready to go. They're ready to go now. The guy's been sipping and they're going to the discotheque to go-go. But she just couldn't stand. She had to break away. Well, New York City really has it all. Oh, yeah, oh, yeah. She is a ball rocker.
Coming up, a review of the new film Angels and Insects. This is Fresh Air. Writer-director Philip Haas spent years making documentaries about artists like David Hockney, Richard Long, and Gilbert and George. Then in 1993, he made his first fiction feature, The Music of Chance, based on a Paul Auster novel. His second feature, which he co-wrote with his wife Belinda, is an adaptation of A.S. Byatt's novella Morpho Eugenia. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Angels and Insects.
At first, it feels like a horror movie. We're on a vast English estate during the Victorian era, and everything feels slightly stilted and portentous. People seem to spend hours brooding darkly, and now and then they inexplicably burst into tears. Something, in other words, is terribly wrong. The house holds some awful secret. In a typical horror movie, we would enter the scene on the coattails of an innocent skeptic, a scientist maybe, investigating the mysterious goings-on that are panicking the peasants. Angels and Insects provides a skeptical scientist, all right, but at first he seems as weird as everybody else. William Adamson, played by the British stage actor Mark Rylance, is a stammering commoner who's just survived a shipwreck, and he has a glazed, frightened look that's anything but heroic. He comes to the estate after years of research in the Amazon, and he's here because the master of the house has hired him to organize and classify his insect collection. But very quickly, he falls in love with the eldest daughter, Eugenia, a blonde beauty played by Patsy Kensit. William has nothing to offer her but his deep-dish understanding of Darwin's thrilling new theories. But for her, it seems enough. He proposes marriage, and she accepts. All of which drives her boorish brother, Edgar, berserk. Edgar, played by Douglas Henschel, does nothing much with his time except ride horses, drink, and take advantage of young servant girls. Yet he considers himself and his family far too good for William, whom he delights in baiting.
You are a miserable creature without breeding or courage. You should stand up, sir, and face me.
I think not. As for breeding, I count my father as a kind man, an honest man, and I know no other good reason for respect. As for courage, I think I may claim that to have lived for 10 years on the Amazons, to have survived murder plots, poisonous snakes, shipwreck, 15 days on a lifeboat in the mid-Atlantic, may reasonably compare with driving a poor horse into a house through a window. I think I know what true courage is. It does not consist in fisticuffs as a response to an insult.
Slowly but surely, the movie catches dramatic fire. And meanwhile, something else is going on underneath. As William studies the household insect collection, he's joined in his researches by the family governess, a poor relation played wonderfully by Kristen Scott Thomas. All those insects swarming and mating and feeding become central to the movie. And soon we notice that the people in this picture are also swarming and mating and feeding. Even the costumes are bee-like and larval and wingy. The film's dark secret turns out to be not supernatural, but biological. This is a movie about romance and manners, but it's also about breeding and evolution and species behavior. And yet the movie never turns into a mere thesis. On the contrary, it gets sexier and funnier and more dramatic as it goes along. In the end, it works up to a climax as creepy as that of any conventional horror movie, but by then this film has soared way beyond convention. Angels and Insects isn't a movie you'll adore or want to see again and again. It isn't a great date movie or a feel-good movie or an action-adventure that leaves you feeling whipped and drained. What it is a little jewel, cold and hard, and in the end, dazzling.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, and Al Banks. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.